how racism in America shapes the economics profession and the way we think about our economic history. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, the 31st of May. Good to have you with us. We will get to those heavier topics in just a bit, but let's start off with a look at the labor market. Last week, first-time unemployment claims dropped to their lowest level since the pandemic began. 406,000 people filed claims. That sounds great compared to any point in the last 15 months, but it's still far higher than the numbers before coronavirus struck. And yet, a lot of employers say they're having a hard time hiring, especially in the hospitality industry. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports.
Hiring had become such a time suck for Wes Hansen that he hired someone to take over hiring. And it's kind of working. He owns a barbecue joint in Phoenix called Pork on a Fork, and he's seeing an increase in applications. But
out of the 250, I think we've interviewed 10.
He says people schedule interviews and don't show up, even when it's just a Zoom call. And it's all starting to make him feel a little crazy.
Are these even real people?
The search for workers is getting so difficult that Jeffrey Bank, who owns Carmine's, an Italian restaurant chain with locations in Atlantic City, Washington, D.C., and other tourist spots, is doing something he hasn't done in years, pounding the pavement.
I talk to doormen in buildings in Manhattan. I talk to people at the gas station.
He expects to need 600 new employees by the end of summer. He's offering $100 to $500 signing bonuses. In fact, every business owner I talk to says they're offering bonuses. David Farahi, COO of Monarch Casino and Resort in Reno, Nevada, has also raised wages. An entry-level housekeeper who once made $15 an hour now makes $17. But
we have not found any kind of silver bullet.
He's still 300 employees short.
What we've had to do is find technological solutions to reduce the need for people.
That means when customers place a sports bet or cash out, they'll interact with a kiosk instead of a cashier. Jennifer Tierney of Tierney Recruiting Services says right now, in addition to how much money and how are the benefits, there's a third question that's coming up more and more.
You know, when I'm interviewing somebody, they're asking me, what does work-life balance look like? They're tired of not having a life, I guess.
The six-day weeks, 12-hour shifts, unpredictable schedules, and the culture.
There is a lot of a**s out there that are running these restaurant companies. And they just come in and scream and yell at people, and people just are sick of it.
She thinks that means the hospitality industry is in for a change. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Wall Street was closed today for the Memorial Day holiday, but we'll have details on the destruction of Black Wall Street when we do the numbers. In part as a response to the murder of George Floyd and the protests of last summer, the Federal Reserve launched a series of conversations, public webinars about racism in the economy. There have been sessions about racism's impact on the education system, housing, employment, and last month, one about racism in the economics profession itself. I moderated a couple of panels at that event, including one on promoting inclusivity in economics and one at the end of the day with the presidents of three of the Fed's regional banks. The Federal Reserve System is one of the largest employers of PhD economists in the United States, and according to a recent count by the New York Times, just 1.3% of them identify as Black. Federal Reserve leadership is overwhelmingly white as well, so I started by asking each of them about some of their big takeaways from the conference.
We want to be top form, and to do that, we have to be diverse. We have to be inclusive.
That's Loretta Mester, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland.
We tend to focus on topics that reflect our own background and our own experience. And if we don't have a diverse group of people in the field, we're not going to have the right topics to be focused on. And I think that's come up very clearly in the discussions.
That's Eric Rosengren, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston.
A line that really stuck out to me was race is a variable that economists are lazy about.
And that's Rafael Bostic, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta.
Race is embedded in a lot of the things that economists treat as controls. So it's always present, even when we act as if it's not, which means we're drawing conclusions oftentimes that are not really reflective of reality. A second thing I would speak to is about intentionality. And I heard a lot about intentionality today, that we need to be forceful about how we build a syllabus to make sure that the voices are diverse. We need to be forceful about who we think to expose our students to. We have to be thoughtful and intentional about how we talk about issues and which issues we even talk about in class. And so we've got to be intentional and we've got to be active to move forward. And those things are things I'm definitely going to take away from today.
One thing, if I may, that I took away from today is that this entire conversation and this entire series really accepts racism in the economy and racism in the economics profession as the default. Yet, there are still some folks who don't believe that this is an issue. And I wonder how being intentional, how you all are thinking about how you have those conversations with not just people in the economics profession, but also the stakeholders with whom you all interact, whether it be members of Congress, whether it be those in the public. How do you have these conversations now with people who are the holdouts? I'll start with you, Loretta.
Well, you're right. There are people who don't get it, but I think there's a lot more people who do get it. And I think one of the things that we're trying to do in Cleveland is have those conversations in our district and expose some of the disparities that exist in terms of economic opportunity, which then lead to differences in economic outcomes. And I would say the business people in Cleveland and the business, they are starting, I would say they're on board. It really affects the bottom line in businesses, right? If you're not diverse. And I think there's a lot of progress being made.
Eric, Fed Chair Powell said on 60 Minutes the other day that he hopes to have people back in the office working at the Fed in person, hopefully by the fall. And I wonder how different of a workplace you think the Federal Reserve banks all over the country are going to be, given that you've been having these conversations.
So we're having this conversation that's very public and many people are viewing it. I'd say we've been having these conversations within the Reserve Bank actually for some time. So I'm actually fairly optimistic. I think if you look at the boards of the Reserve Banks, they're far more diverse than they were 10 or 15 years ago. Now, that's not to say that we don't have a lot more room for improvement, but I would say that I think there is a different discussion that we're having now, and certainly the discussion in the country is different than just a few years ago.
Rafael, if I can turn to you, so much of the conversation today has been about representation, who gets their journal articles published, who gets elevated, who has the networks, and that matters a lot for a journalist like me who talks to economists all the time, because who are the top ranked or known economists shape the economic narrative. And I'm thinking about that a lot with a debate over inflation and how you all are talking about it versus how the media is talking about it and therefore how the public perceives it. What are you all doing in terms of concrete steps to think about the role that diversity in economics plays and how everyone talks and thinks about the economy?
Well, in terms of what we're doing and how we think about inflation, I will just give an example of what we've done in our bank. So just yesterday, we had an economic briefing, and the question was, how do people at different stations in life respond when inflation happens? And what we found is that there are very different responses by income level and by extension, depending on your racial background and what your history is. And so that will inform how I think about what I should expect to see in my modeling about how the economy is going to perform moving forward, which then in turn will inform how I think we should want to do our monetary policy. And it's a direct byproduct of really planning for sessions like this and having more conversations that bring in a different set of voices.
Once again, that was Atlanta Fed President Rafael Bostic, Boston Fed President Eric Rosengren, and Cleveland Fed President Loretta J. Mester at the Federal Reserve's public conference about racism and the economics profession. The whole video's online at marketplace.org. the CDC's pandemic eviction moratorium expires at the end of June, and housing advocates warn millions of people could be forced out of their homes when that happens. There is federal aid for renters and landlords, but the distribution is slow going. In Houston, which had over 30,000 eviction cases filed during the pandemic, local officials are scrambling to hand out more than $150 million in rent relief. But as Houston Public Media's Jen Rice reports, landlords aren't necessarily rushing to sign up.
Janet is a home health care worker in Houston. Back in February, when the big freeze hit Texas, she couldn't make it to work. She got fired, and soon she couldn't pay her rent.
It's been hard. I've gone days without sleeping. You know, you can't sleep. You know, you don't know what's going to happen.
We're just using her middle name because of her immigration status, and she's afraid of retaliation from her landlord. Her landlord filed for eviction. Houston, unlike some other cities, never put a local eviction moratorium in place during the pandemic, and the federal CDC moratorium hasn't stopped most evictions in the Houston area. But a judge ruled that Janet could stay, for now. She repeatedly asked her landlord to apply with her for state and local rental relief, but says he refused to participate. Her landlord did not respond to our request for comment. With the CDC order currently set to expire at the end of June, she feels she's racing to catch up on rent in time. Brian Swern is an attorney who represents Houston landlords. He says there are lots of reasons why landlords don't want to participate in government rent assistance programs. Many would rather evict than deal with delays and red tape.
In general, kind of fatigue and wanting to get residents who have not paid rent for a long time out of the community. A second is just a fear of losing their place in line with the eviction court.
A study from the National Low Income Housing Coalition found that nationwide, 90% of rent relief programs were set up for money to go directly to the landlord, and half the programs reported they were struggling with landlord participation. Swern says if officials really wanted the programs to work, they would be at the courthouses with a checkbook.
Talk to the landlord in the hallway while the case is on hold for a few minutes, not reset. Turn to the tenant. Do you agree? Landlord, do you agree on this number? Here's your check.
Towards the end of 2020, there was a registry with around 8,000 renters who weren't eligible for relief money yet because their landlords weren't enrolled in the program. That's according to Baker Ripley, one of the local nonprofits managing Houston's program. At one time, the payments went only to landlords. Now, those payments can also go to tenants. But Renee Solis of Baker Ripley says there's a lot of demand.
We have a $159 million program, and we received $202 million in requests.
The city passed an eviction grace period in February to give renters more time to receive that money and pay rent. Mayor Sylvester Turner made the announcement.
I do not think people ought to be evicted when these dollars are coming in this time period because the dollars are there.
But an analysis of eviction data by the consulting group January Advisors found that the grace period had little effect on stopping or delaying evictions before it expired at the end of March. Around 80% of applicants to the local program have been selected and are moving through the pipeline. But some renters, like Janet, are still waiting. Here's Solis again.
Most folks have not had to wait that long. It really depends on two factors. One is your priority, which is essentially a designation of your vulnerability. And then the second thing is just the lottery. You know, when your name gets pulled out based on your priority.
Janet finally did get some good news. She has an offer from the state rent relief program, though it requires she stay with her current landlord. The state's $1 billion fund is just getting going. Janet is waiting to receive more than $6,000 to pay past and future rent. The offer wasn't Janet's only good news. She was relieved to say she's also just started a new job. In Houston, I'm Jen Rice for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it is supremely comfortable. It's airy. It's bright.
An ode to electric cars. But first, let's do the numbers. Markets here in the U.S. were closed today for the Memorial Day holiday. President Biden also declared today a day of national remembrance. It's been 100 years since the Tulsa race massacre started. By the end of June 1st, 1921, a white mob had killed hundreds of black Tulsans and burned much of the thriving Greenwood neighborhood where they lived, also known as Black Wall Street. In those 35 square blocks, the mob burned 1,200 homes, 31 restaurants, more than two dozen grocery stores, a dozen churches, eight doctor's offices, five hotels, four drugstores, and the Greenwood Public Library. Victims filed $1.8 million worth of claims. That's at least $27 million of today's dollars. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. Memorial Day weekend traditionally marks the start of summer vacation season, a moment when many tourist destinations in the U.S. begin to see crowds, and when the people who work at tourist attractions and the hotels and restaurants near them start getting busy. Marketplace's Mariel Segura reports on what that looks like in the Black Hills region of South Dakota.
The Black Hills are known for Mount Rushmore, the Crazy Horse Memorial, the Gold Rush City of Deadwood, and for reptile gardens, the world's largest reptile zoo, according to the Guinness Book of World Records. It has lizards on display and alligators you can feed.
There's also the tortoise yard with our giant tortoises that the people can pet.
John Brocklesby is head of public relations. His father started the business 84 years ago.
We started 4 years before the completion of Mount Rushmore.
Brocklesby is expecting huge crowds this summer, which is great because it's expensive to run a zoo and...
Last year, of course, we lost money.
Nearby, in Rapid City, South Dakota, you'll find Prairie Edge, a store that sells Native American artwork, craft supplies, and books. Frank Nightpipe is head of retail sales, and he says the crowds are already coming.
I mean, of course, it's Memorial Day weekend. Everybody has a weekend off, but I haven't seen numbers like this before, and I've been here 13 years.
The demand is overwhelming for some businesses. Carrie Gerlach owns Black Hills Adventure Tours. Her kayaking, hiking, and biking tours are sold out for the next 3 weeks, and she's had trouble getting her hands on enough kayaks and bikes.
So with the kayaks, I've just been kind of resorting to Facebook Marketplace. I've also gone to local pawn shops and looked for people that want to sell bikes.
She also books hotel rooms and cabins for her customers.
And this year, I'm running into a situation where everything is sold out.
The crowds are a complete 180 from a few months ago. Jay Ringlespaugh is marketing director for Tatanka, Story of the Bison, a museum about the relationship between bison and the Lakota and Great Plains people.
As the marketing director, you know, last year I felt like I was crawling on my hands and knees trying to beg people to come. And this year I'm like, if you could just not on certain days, that'd be great.
That's how quickly this economy has changed. I'm Mariel Segura for Marketplace. AAA says about 37 million people are traveling this Memorial Day holiday. 9 out of 10 of them are driving more than 50 miles from home. With average gas prices topping $3 a gallon and rising, electric vehicles are looking a lot more appealing to more drivers. And the automotive industry is preparing to go fully electric sooner than many expected. Rapid advances in tech could soon make electric vehicles the cheapest cars in town. The BBC's Justin Rowlett has more.
A quiet revolution is taking place on the streets of Norway as consumers move from this... the silent speed of an electric car. The Nordic country is switching over to the new technology more rapidly than anywhere else on Earth, with pure electric cars making up around 60% of overall new sales. Schulk Kulter is a sustainable technology researcher based in the Norwegian city of Trondheim.
So in Norway, if you look at the amount of incentives that is needed to actually drive this large share, that is something that no other country in the world will be able to actually pay for.
But how will the rest of the world afford one without the Norwegian-style financial incentives? Well, it mainly comes down to the non-beating heart of the vehicle, the battery, the cost of which is now a tenth of what it was a decade ago.
Over the last 10 years, the cost has come down just mind-bogglingly quickly from $1,000 per kilowatt hour to close to the $100 mark now. But I think that there is a pathway to get to a sub-$60 battery in the next decade, which is just a dream.
Madeline Tyson works for the clean energy research group RMI. She says overall, it's often cheaper now to own an electric car than a traditional petrol or diesel vehicle.
I think the best evidence of that is how fleets are targeting electrification. In a recent study RMI did, 80% of the respondents said that they were in the process of electrifying their fleet. That has a lot to do with the ratio of oil prices to electricity, as well as the difference in the operation and maintenance costs.
In neighboring Sweden, another Nordic country with huge electric car sales, the carmaker Volvo has come up with one of the most ambitious industry plans. From 2030, all new vehicles it sells will be fully electric. Bjorn Anwall is the head of Volvo Cars in Europe.
We need to change consumer behavior, and such things takes time. And that's the key role that our plug-in hybrids are playing right now, because through them, consumers get used to how it is to charge, what is your driving pattern, and by that, we ease the way for fully electric cars.
So aside from the environmental benefits of electric cars, what will attract more people on board? Quentin Wilson is a motoring journalist. Back in the 1990s, he presented the BBC's car review programme, Top Gear. Today, he's the proud owner of a Tesla Model 3, because one day, 24 years ago, Quentin fell in love with electric vehicles.
General Motors spent $1 billion producing this really wonderful electric car in the early days, and I went over in Top Gear and tested it in LA and was amazed the way it was so smooth and fast. I mean, the range was miserable, and in the end, it ran out of juice. My Tesla will do 0 to 60 in 3.1 seconds. There is no range anxiety. It is supremely comfortable. It's airy. It's bright. It's just a complete joy.
The new figures suggest he is right. Global sales of electric vehicles topped 3 million last year, up 43%, and that is despite overall car sales slumping by a fifth because of the pandemic. In London, I'm the BBC's Justin Rowlatt for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, Memorial Day's origins trace back to the aftermath of the Civil War and political divisions in the country over who should be honored and how. That ties to today's debate over what should be done with Confederate memorials. According to Smithsonian Magazine, at least $40 million in taxpayer money was spent from 2008 to 2018 on Confederate monuments and the groups that maintain them. Efforts to remove them can also be costly. According to CNN, the removal of four Confederate monuments in New Orleans cost the city more than $2 million. Most of that money came from litigation and mitigating safety concerns for those working on the removal project. Here's your moment of economic context. I mentioned earlier about all those people traveling for the holidays, but most by car. Some disturbing numbers about folks traveling by air. There's been a drastic spike in unruly passenger incidents. So far this year, the FAA has received about 2,500 reports of bad behavior, mostly people refusing to comply with the mask mandate. This rise in aggressiveness and violence translates into almost 400 FAA enforcement actions so far this year. That's more than double the normal count for the whole year. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.